Thank you very much, Amy. So, despite having the very first time slot of the last day of the conference and not being a morning person besides that, I am still very pleased and excited to present my own work on mandatory HIV testing for foreign nationals in the Republic of Korea. And before I jump in, I just want to clarify that although I work for the Texas Health Department in HIV prevention, this work is in no way affiliated with the health department. It was done on my own time, in my own capacity as an independent advocate on the issue. No relationships to disclose. So this is a roadmap of what my presentation will cover. I'm going to start off by briefly describing the HIV epidemic in Korea and some of the social and cultural barriers to effective research and policy on HIV prevention in the country. And then I'm going to talk about the immigration programs that are primarily affected by the HIV testing requirement, and that's going to be the foreign language instructor, which is under the E2 visa, and the non-professional employment under the E9 visa, which is primarily reserved for manual laborers. I'm going to discuss the legal and policy frameworks around the testing requirement, give a brief timeline that shows kind of how the testing requirements came to be, and then finally I'm going to discuss the UN case that was brought before the Committee to End Racial Discrimination that resulted in a ruling this past May that the policy constituted racial discrimination, and some of the next steps for advocacy, which have been evolving up until yesterday afternoon. So this is a busy slide. It's a full timeline of the HIV epidemic in Korea and the government's policy responses to it. And there's a lot here, so I don't want to go into a huge amount of detail, but there are three points that I want to take care to point out. This first one here was 1987, which is kind of when HIV and AIDS exploded onto the national scene in Korea. And in response to that, in addition to a couple of other things, the government passed the AIDS Prevention Act in November, which implemented regular mandatory testing for what the government defined as high-risk groups at the time. And those groups included commercial sex workers, prison inmates, overseas sailors, hair salon employees, and food industry sanitation workers. And that regular mandatory testing continued until the year 2000, when the government dropped the requirement and shifted its focus onto voluntary testing, counseling, and prevention. So fast forwarding to 2004, which was when the EPS program for migrant workers was launched, and the HIV testing requirement from them was implemented in the MOUs with the sending countries. And then finally in 2007, the government introduced mandatory HIV and drug testing for foreign English teachers coming in through a policy memo. And I'll get into more detail on the later half of this timeline later on in the presentation. So this is just a cursory look at new diagnoses in Korea to get kind of a picture of total diagnosis, and this includes both Korean citizens and foreigners put together. So HIV, Korea is currently considered a low HIV burden country, but as you can see, new infections are going up pretty steadily every year, and most analyses expect this trend to continue. It's also pretty clear that the epidemic is very heavily concentrated among men, which leads most epidemiologists to think that it's primarily driven by MSM. And what's not shown here is that late diagnoses are also on the rise, which has been a trend that they've seen since the mandatory testing was abolished in 2000. So unfortunately, HIV research and policy in the country are not very advanced. There's almost no proactive public health prevention work going on in the country at all, and even the at-risk populations actively avoid getting tested because of the very heavy stigma attached to the disease. The government's own policies and responses to HIV tend to be pretty reactionary, and they really only move in response to public opinion, and their policies are based on things that will kind of placate the public, which is also not very informed on HIV, and so their overall policy framework is not really science-based at all. And unfortunately, as a result of this, research on HIV, particularly HIV epidemiology and sociology, is also not very advanced, as you can kind of see from the dates on some of these studies. So HIV sociology in particular is it's going, but the research is really in its infancy, and they've really only just started to look at risk behaviors and attitudes and practices revolving HIV among society and providers. And the one thing that's actually not included on this list of first studies that I wanted to include, because PrEP is such a big part of the conversation with HIV now, is that in last year, there was a study published that was a mathematical model on how the introduction of PrEP might impact the HIV epidemic and might help with prevention. But that's, to this day, to date, that's pretty much all they've done, is just a mathematical model and comparing it with ARVs and increased promotion of condom use. So switching gears a little bit, I wanted to talk about the visa categories that are primarily impacted by this policy. And the first one is the foreign language instructor, which is under the E2 visa. And this group is very small, but it's arguably the most visible group of foreigners in Korea. And that's because we obviously look very foreign and we teach in schools, so we're out and among Korean society. This program got its start with the Peace Corps in 1981, which started placing teachers when it first got into the country, English teachers, when it first started being active in the country. And then the Fulbright program started placing professors in universities in 1992. Then the Korean government decided to kind of take over, and so the Department of Education launched the EPIC program in 1995, which places teachers in public schools. But most English teachers in the country are not actually employed in public schools, but in what are called hagwons, which are private English academies that the kids go to after they finish their day school. And that was where my husband and I worked, actually. We worked at a hagwon called ECC. And so the vast majority of teachers work in these private hagwons. The teaching contracts are typically for a year. Up until now, airfare both coming and going is provided. And in order to qualify, you have to have a university degree from a qualifying country, a federal criminal background check, and negative HIV and drug tests. And this is just a breakdown of where E2 visa holders come from, and this is for the year 2014 in total. And so, as you can see, there are E2 visas that are issued for teachers of languages other than English. Teachers of Chinese make up about 8% of this, but for the most part, this visa applies to native-speaking English teachers, and over half of them are actually Americans. And in contrast to the English teacher, the E9 visa holders, the EPS workers, are probably one of the least visible groups of foreigners in Korea, but they are also by far the largest. As of last month, there were 300,000 registered E9 visa holders in the country, and that's not counting the unregistered, the undocumented migrants that find their way into the country to work in these manual labor industries, which is at least as many as the number of legal ones, if not more. So these workers, they tend to work almost exclusively in manual labor industries, and that's going to be agriculture, fishing, construction, and livestock. And they come in through MOUs with their sending countries. And in order to qualify for this visa, they have to pass the TOPIK test, which is the test of proficiency in Korean. And this, similarly, is a breakdown of where the E9 visa holders tend to come from. So the countries which send the most workers are listed here on the left, and the numbers are broken down just by overall region on the right, and it's pretty obvious that the vast majority of them come from Southeast Asia. And several of the sending countries are high HIV burden countries, and those are the ones that are highlighted in red here. So the second half of the HIV in Korea timeline gives us a closer look at the mandatory testing policies as they're applied to foreign workers. And as you can see here, the HIV testing for migrant workers was launched with the launch of the EPS program itself in 2004, and testing for English teachers was launched with a policy memo in 2007. Now, English teachers, native-speaking teachers, being from high-income countries, being a relatively privileged group and a relatively vocal group, there was a lot of backlash to the HIV testing policy when it was first rolled out. They started testing teachers in 2008 and 2009, and there was a lot of anger in response to that, and actually quite a few English teachers in the country at the time quit their jobs and left in protest, while others filed complaints of human rights violations within Korea itself. So two in particular stand out and are continuing, and that's Andrea Vandam, who is an American woman, and Lisa Griffin, who is a New Zealand national. So these two women, with others, filed complaints of human rights violations with the Korea Constitutional Court and the National Human Rights Commission of Korea, and both of those cases were rejected, and so they went on to press their cases with international bodies. I'm going to have to fly through this because we're on a short time limit. So this slide looks at the HIV testing requirements for the two visa categories side by side. And we've already discussed most of this, but what I want to point out is that after Lisa Griffin filed her case with the UN Committee to End Racial Discrimination in 2012, Korea actually very quietly made some changes to its testing policies that were rolled out in 2013. For English teachers, they dropped the yearly testing requirement and they changed the language in their code to refer to physical examination reports. But the ambiguity of this language and the fact that HIV tests are included in the physical examination reports allows them to continue the testing policy. Whereas for the EPS workers, because the test requirement is in the MOUs with sending countries, it's not sort of on the books for them. So the only thing that was in the policy for these workers were these health verification letters that were required. I think I'm going to go ahead and skip these and go to the UN cert decision, because that's the meat of what is now hopefully going to be the driver of change to this policy. So Lisa Griffin, the New Zealand woman who filed her case with the CERD, got a victory in May. So the case was filed in 2012, and this past May, the CERD issued its decision, predictably and rightfully in her favor, that the policy of mandatory testing constituted racial discrimination, and they ordered her employer, which was the Ulsan Metropolitan Office of Education, to pay her back wages and compensation for emotional damage. And one thing that they noted in particular was that the justification provided by the Korean government for this policy had nothing to do with public health, and they stated outright that the tests were a means to check the values and morals of foreign teachers as they were coming into the country. And something else that was stated explicitly that reinforced the ruling was the fact that Korean teachers who teach at the side by side with their Western counterparts, and even foreigners of Korean ethnicity were also exempted from the testing requirement. So if you were an American, for example, who was ethnically Korean, if you had any Korean blood, you were exempted from the requirement. So the CERD pretty much saw through the policy and they said, no, this constitutes racial discrimination. Now, getting into international law a little bit, what's interesting is that Korea's treaty with the CERD is pretty advanced and it gives the treaty body the same authority as domestic law. So in theory, this decision should be binding within the country, but the Korean government and the legal system has no interest in doing so, and there's very little awareness of this treaty, and the decision wasn't published anywhere in Korean language media after it was issued in May. So for next steps, as Amy mentioned, we had a victory at the Governing Council yesterday. We introduced a late breaker for APHA to take opposition to any immigration policy that required HIV tests for foreign workers to obtain visas, and it passed with overwhelming support, which is fantastic. So that's going to have to be followed up by a full policy proposal next year, and hopefully will also lay the groundwork for us to be able to advocate from within APHA. I've also been working with the human rights attorney who filed the CERD case, trying to pressure UNAIDS to revoke Korea's status as a country without any HIV-related travel restrictions, because it conferred that status onto Korea without it deserving it. And then we've also been in communication with the Korean Public Health Association and some human rights organizations in Korea, such as the Gwangju International Center, which hosts a forum on human rights every year. And that's it.
Remind us what CERD stands for.
Yes, the UN CERD is the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. And just as an FYI, the American woman, Andrea Vandam, filed her case with the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and that case is still pending.
Great. Thank you.